Hello, friend. I need to tell you about a book that had me completely locked in. It's called Run on Red by Noel W. Eiley. Picture this, a dark, empty highway through the Idaho hills. No cell signal for miles. Two women realize the headlights behind them aren't going away. What starts as road rage turns into something far worse, a brutal, heart-pounding fight for survival that doesn't let up for a single page. Laura and Olivia can't outrun what's coming, so they have to fight back. And this book does what the best thrillers do. It takes an ordinary situation and makes you realize how fast it can go sideways. I burned through it. Every chapter drops you off a cliff. If you're into Freda McFadden or Karen Slaughter, this is your next read. Run on Red is now available as a deluxe special edition with gorgeous stenciled edges, as beautiful on the shelf as it is terrifying in your hands. Out February 24th. Grab it while you can. 5 years. That's how long it took. 5 years from the night 3-year-old Francis Saville Kent was murdered in his family's country house until someone finally told the truth. 5 years of whispers and suspicion. 5 years of a brilliant detective's ruined career. 5 years of a family scattered across England, running from scandal they couldn't escape. In August 1860, the charges against 16-year-old Constance Kent were dismissed for insufficient evidence. She walked free from Trowbridge Town Hall, while Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher watched his career collapse around him. Everyone had an opinion about who killed Francis. Almost no one believed the detective who had actually solved the case. Constance could have stayed silent forever. The investigation was closed. The newspapers moved on. Her father sent her far from England, to convents and finishing schools where no one knew her name. But some secrets are too heavy to carry, and Constance Kent was about to face something more relentless than any detective, more unforgiving than any court, more impossible to escape than any scandal, her own conscience. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. This is the story of 5 years of silence and the religious torment that finally broke it.
Road Hill House was no longer home. It was a crime scene that everyone recognized and no one could forget. The servants who remained whispered in corners and avoided the family. New staff refused positions. Word had spread across Wiltshire that the Kent household was cursed. Neighbours who once called for tea now crossed the street when they saw the Kent family carriage. The high walls that had once protected the family's respectability now felt like the walls of a prison. Samuel Kent tried to maintain appearances. He still held his government position as factory inspector, still attended church services every Sunday, still hosted dinners for local society, though the guest list grew shorter each month. But every conversation eventually circled back to the same unasked question: what really happened that June night? And young Francis? 3 years and 10 months old when he died. His nursery stood empty now. His wicker cot, where Elizabeth Gough had found only rumpled blankets that terrible morning, someone had moved it to the attic. His toys? The wooden rocking horse, the tin soldiers, the stuffed rabbit he couldn't sleep without, were packed away, as though erasing the physical evidence could erase what had happened. Mary Drew Pratt, the stepmother who had replaced Constance's real mother, seemed determined to prove that life continued. She gave birth to another son, Ackland, in July 1860, just weeks after Francis's murder. Another daughter, Florence, followed in 1861. New children to replace the murdered child, new life to bury the death. But some things cannot be buried. By early 1861, Samuel Kent made a decision. The family would leave Road Hill House forever. They moved away from Wiltshire, away from the whispers and the stares and the neighbours who would never forget. And Constance, the daughter half of England believed had killed her brother, she would be sent away when no one knew her name. First to a French convent across the Channel, far from English newspapers and English scandal. Then, in 1863, to St Mary's Home for Religious Ladies in Brighton. A place of prayer, a place of strict routine, a place where Constance Kent would finally break her silence.
There was someone else who knew what happened that night at Road Hill House. Someone who returned to boarding school in the autumn of 1860. Built a career, married, had children, and never faced a single question from police again. Someone who may have been in that nursery alongside Constance. Her brother, William. William Saville Kent was 14 years old in June 1860. He slept on the same floor as Constance. He shared her grievances against their stepmother, Mary Drew Pratt. He had witnessed the same systematic erasure of their real mother's memory. He had endured the same favoritism shown to the second family's children. And in 1857, Constance and William had run away together, disguised themselves as boys, fled to Bath before being discovered. These two siblings were capable of conspiracy. The evidence at the time raised questions no one wanted to pursue. William's testimony at the inquest was evasive, nervous, contradictory. Inspector Witcher noted in his reports that the boy avoided eye contact and sweated through simple questions. But Witcher was focused on Constance. The local constabulary was focused on protecting the family from scandal. No one pressed William the way they pressed his sister. And then there were the practical problems with Constance acting alone. Francis Saville Kent weighed approximately 30 pounds, the distance from nursery to outdoor privy, 30 yards across rain-soaked ground in the dark. A 16-year-old girl carrying a struggling 3-year-old child, while also carrying her father's razor, navigating stairs that creaked, opening doors that should have woken the household. Did she really do this alone? Modern historians, including Kate Summerscale, who wrote the definite account of this case, have suggested a disturbing possibility. William helped. He may have held Francis while Constance cut. He may have carried the body to the privy. He may have retrieved the razor and disposed of it. And when Constance confessed 5 years later, she may have confessed alone to protect him. William Saville Kent graduated from boarding school, attended university, became a marine biologist of considerable reputation. In 1884, just 1 year before Constance was released from prison, he immigrated to Australia. Was this coincidence? Or was he putting an ocean between himself and the sister who kept his secret for 2 decades? William died in Bournemouth, England, in 1908, age 62. He never faced charges, never publicly acknowledged his possible role, never explained why he fled to Australia the moment his sister's release approached, taking whatever he knew to his grave. But while William built his respectable career, Constance was about to tear her life apart, not through investigation, not through evidence, through something far more powerful than any detective. Religion.
St. Mary's Home for Religious Ladies in Brighton was not a typical Church of England establishment. It was run by Father Arthur Wagner, a priest of the Anglo-Catholic movement, sometimes called High Church Anglicism. Wagner believed in rituals that most English Protestants associated with Roman Catholicism. Incense clouding the sanctuary air, elaborate vestments embroidered with gold thread, bells marking the elevation of the host, and most critically, for Constance Kent, the sacrament of confession. Arthur Wagner came from wealth and influence. His father, Henry Mitchell Wagner, had been vicar of Brighton for 46 years, one of the longest tenures in the Church of England history. Arthur used his family inheritance to build churches in poor neighbourhoods and establish homes for what Victorians called fallen women, unmarried mothers, former prostitutes, troubled girls. St Mary's Home was one of these establishments. But Wagner's theory was intense. He believed that sin had physical weight on the soul, that guilt accumulated like sediment layer upon layer until the soul could no longer bear the burden. That confession, genuine, complete, sacramental confession, was the only path to absolution. And that early justice and heavenly forgiveness were connected. You could not receive God's mercy while hiding mortal sin from the world. Constance Kent entered St Mary's Home in 1863. She was 18 years old. Ostensibly, she was there to recover from the trauma of being accused of her brother's murder, to find peace through prayer and structured religious life, to escape the scandal that had followed her family since that June night. In reality, she had entered a pressure cooker of guilt. For the next 2 years, Constance lived in an environment of inconstant religious intensity. Daily services at dawn and dusk, weekly confession, seasonal rituals that emphasise sin, sacrifice and redemption. The liturgical calendar became psychological pressure. Lent's 40 days focus on repentance. Good Friday's meditation on innocent blood. Easter's promise of resurrection, but only through truth. Every week, Constance knelt in the confession booth with Father Wagner. The wooden partition between them, the smell of incense and old wood. Wagner's voice asked the ritual questions about sin and contrition. Every week, the same unspoken question hung between them. And every week, Wagner's theology pressed harder. Your soul cannot find peace while you hide mortal sin. Earthly justice must be served before heavenly forgiveness. The seal of confession, sacramental secrecy, meant that he could tell no one what she said in that booth. But he was free to guide her conscience, to remind her, week after week, that redemption required truth. This was not sudden dramatic conversion. This was slow accumulated weight. 2 years of daily services. 2 years of weekly confession. 2 years of liturgical seasons emphasising blood and guilt and redemption. By Easter 1864, something in Constance Kent was about to break.
While Constance Kent knelt in confession booths, in Brighton, England, moved on, the Rothill House murder faded from the front pages. New scandals, new crimes, new sensations captured public attention. A child's murder in a country house became yesterday's news, replaced by fresh horrors and fresh outrages. Most people assumed the case would never be solved. Inspector John Witcher certainly knew better, but no one was listening to him anymore. His evidence had been sound, his logic impeccable, his detective work brilliant. He had identified the killer within days of arriving at Rothill House. The missing nightgown, the circumstantial evidence pointing to Constance, the psychological profile of a teenage girl, driven by jealousy and neglect. But in 1860, being right meant nothing against class prejudice. The newspapers that had destroyed his reputation moved on to new targets. His colleagues at Scotland Yard distanced themselves. No one wanted association with the detective who had accused a gentleman's daughter and failed to convict her. By March 1864, Witcher was forced into retirement at age 50. The official reason, congestion of the brain. Real reason, his career had been murdered alongside Francis Kent. But the Rothill House case would not stay buried. In 1868, 3 years after Constance's confession, Wilkie Collins published a novel that would change literature forever, The Moonstone. Collins had followed the case obsessively. His fictional detective, Sergeant Cuff, was modeled directly on Inspector Witcher. The country house setting, the family scandal, the missing nightgown evidence, the solution that no one wanted to hear. The Moonstone is often called the first modern detective novel. Without the Roadhill House murder, without Inspector Witcher's brilliant and tragic investigation, detective fiction as we know it might never have existed. But while Witcher retired in obscurity and Collins wrote fiction, Constance Kent was living real life in a Brighton confession booth. And Easter, 1864, was approaching.
Easter week, 1864, Constance Kent was 19 years old. 4 years had passed since the murder of her half-brother Francis. 4 years of daily services. 4 years of weekly confession. 4 years of liturgical seasons, emphasising sin, blood, sacrifice and redemption. And now the most intense week of the Christian calendar had arrived. The exact date of Constance's confession to Father Wagner remains unknown. The seal of confession means no records exist. But it was sometime during Lent or Easter of 1864 that she finally spoke the words aloud in that wooden booth. She had murdered Francis Saville Kent. She had taken her father's razor from his dressing room. Around midnight on June the 29th, 1860, she had gone to the nursery. She had lifted her three-year-old half-brother from his cot. The boy had received all the love she had been denied. She had carried him through the dark house, down the stairs, out into the rain-soaked garden. In the outdoor privy, 30 yards from the house, she had cut his throat. She had wrapped his small body in his own nursery blanket and stuffed him down into the vault. The nightgown, the missing nightgown that had haunted Inspector Witcher's investigation, she had burnt or otherwise destroyed. It would never be found. What she said about William, whether her brother helped, whether he knew, whether he carried the body or disposed of evidence, remains unknown. That secret, if it exists, stayed in the confessional. Father Wagner's response was clear. Constance must give herself up. She must confess publicly. She must accept whatever punishment the law demanded. In his theology, earthly justice was required before heavenly forgiveness could be complete. Was this spiritual guidance or religious coercion? Wagner saw himself as saving her soul, guiding a young woman toward redemption through truth. Modern observers might see a priest manipulating a vulnerable penitent, using religious authority to compel a confession the courts had failed to obtain. The truth likely contains both. Constance agreed, whether from genuine remorse for murdering a three-year-old child, whether from theological fear of eternal damnation, whether from the desperate desire to finally end 4 years of unbearable secret, or perhaps to protect her brother William by taking full responsibility alone. She agreed to surrender. Nearly a year passed before she acted. Time to prepare, time to settle affairs, time for Wagner to arrange the logistics of a public confession. The date was set, April the 25th, 1865, Bow Street Police Station in London. After 5 years of silence, Constance Kent was going to tell the truth.
The morning of April 25th, 1865, Father Wagner and Constance Kent left St. Mary's home in Brighton. They boarded a train for London. She wore modest traveling clothes, dark fabric, nothing that drew attention. He wore his clerical collar. They spoke little during the journey. There was nothing left to say. Bow Street Police Station was one of the most famous in London, home of the original Bow Street Runners, predecessors to the Metropolitan Police. When Wagner and Constance arrived mid-morning, she asked to speak to a magistrate. What happened next took less than an hour. Constance Kent dictated a written confession. She admitted to the murder of Francis Saville Kent on the night of June 29, 1860. She provided details that matched the evidence Inspector Witcher had gathered 5 years earlier. Details only the killer could have known. She said she acted alone. Her stated motive? When pressed, she refused to elaborate. The confession mentioned resentment, but offered no details. Was she protecting William? Was there something darker in the family? She still wouldn't reveal. Her silence on motive has puzzled historians for over a century. By evening, telegraph wires hummed with the news. Headlines screamed across Europe. Hill House murderess confesses. Constance Kent surrenders after 5 years. The public was stunned. Half of England had defended her in 1860. They had attacked Inspector Witcher for daring to accuse a young lady of breeding. They had called him a monster for interrogating a teenage girl. Now, she admitted she was guilty all along. Samuel Kent, her father, reportedly said he always feared it was her. But he had spent 5 years fighting anyone who suggested his daughter's guilt, protecting her, defending her. His favorite son murdered by his second favorite daughter. His family destroyed, utterly. And somewhere in London, a retired detective named Jonathan Witcher heard the news. He had known since July 1860. He had tried to tell them. They had destroyed his career for it. Now, 5 years too late, everyone knew. Constance Kent was remanded to custody and transported to Devizes to await trial. The newspapers that had destroyed Inspector Witcher 5 years earlier now admitted they had gotten it wrong. The young lady of breeding had murdered her baby brother. Victorian England had chosen class prejudice over truth. For those who had defended Constance in 1860, the confession was a betrayal. They had believed in her innocence. They had attacked the police for prosecuting a respectable family. Now they learned they had been protecting a murderer. For Inspector Witcher, the vindication was bitter. Too late to save his reputation. Too late to save his health. Too late for anything except the cold comfort of being right. But questions remained. Why had Constance Kent confessed after 5 years of freedom? Was it genuine religious conversion? Father Wagner's theology finally breaking through her defenses? Was it religious coercion? A priest manipulating a vulnerable young woman? Or was she taking full responsibility to protect someone else? Her brother William, who had built his career while she built her guilt. And what would happen next? The charge was murder. The standard sentence was death by hanging. Would Victorian England execute a 21-year-old woman for a crime committed when she was 16? Would she finally reveal her true motive? Would anyone else be implicated? On July 21, 1865, Constance Emily Kent stood in the dock at Devizes facing the judge who would decide her fate. She had confessed to murdering her 3-year-old brother. The prosecution wanted her dead. Her defense lawyer wanted her committed to an asylum. And Constance herself wanted something no one expected. To take full responsibility, accept her punishment, and finally, perhaps, find peace. But the British legal system wasn't done with its surprises, and neither was Constance Kent. Until next time, remember, guilt doesn't keep a calendar. Constance Kent could have stayed silent forever. The investigation was closed. The world had moved on. But some truths are too heavy to carry alone. And 5 years of religious pressure finally broke what Victorian justice never could. Sometimes the confession that saves your soul is the one that destroys your life. Next week on Foul Play, the trial that lasted 30 minutes. Thanks for listening, friend.